Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the Subcommittee on Clean Water. This is March 16th, 2009. And before we hear from our folks from the agencies, Mr. Mueller is going to go over a spreadsheet from what we did in the past so that we have a reference to compare with what we're going to hear about today. And then we will hear from the agencies in detail about the governor's proposal simply for the Clean Water Fund. This isn't the whole governor's proposal for environment. And then I want to remind folks that on Wednesday we're going to meet again at 3 o'clock and we'll begin to hear bills that have come forward regarding the Clean Water Fund. Those of us who are optimistic would like to finish by 4:30 so some of you can enjoy 64 degrees is what I hear is going on out there. So, Mr. Mueller.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'll be quickly going through this one-page handout that I put together that shows the first column says one-time general fund, and that was the general fund dollars that were appropriated in the current biennium, the one that we're in right now. We made those appropriations in the 2007 legislature. These amounts that are shown in that column reflect the unallotments and any other reductions that were made to those original appropriations. So it was a total of $52.21 million of one-time general fund dollars spent on what we are calling Clean Water Legacy programs. This does not include anything that might have been in the bonding bill, especially like for PFA or other bonding projects through DNR or Bowser that could be considered maybe by some to be clean water type programs. So like I said, the current biennium we're in right now, total of $52.21 million of general fund dollars. Then we go over the next columns are all the governor's proposals for the various agencies put together. The governor's proposal has $39.484 million in 2010 and $78.741 million in 2011. And then right below that on the bottom of the page, I'm also listing what is available from the Clean Water Fund in the February forecast. That first line shows the first number, the $69.52 million, already is 90% of the available fund in the first year. And below that, it shows the other 10% if we decide to leave a 10% balance in the fund. So going by that, there's $69.52 million available in fiscal year 2010 and about $81.5 million in fiscal year 2011. You round those, you get almost exactly, you get about exactly $151 million for the two-year period. Now, the governor proposal has much less than that. The governor chose to do only about $39.484 million the first year and $78.7 million the second year, total of $118.2 million. So there's still some room above and beyond the governor's proposal, I think, to offer to do a little bit more out of the Clean Water Fund. So this is just sort of trying to put everything on one page of what all the different agencies have proposed in the governor's budget and then comparing that to what we've appropriated in the current biennium.
Madam Chair?
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Mueller, how did you arrive at the 77.25 for the 10% balance?
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, that's just taking, if you add those two numbers up, the 69.5 and the 7.7 million, you add those two up, that's what's available in the fund the first year. So 90% is the 69 million and 10% is the 7.7 million. So that's if we decide to leave a 10% balance in the Clean Water Fund the first year, we can appropriate about 69.5 million.
Mr. Mueller, are these calculations based on the February forecast?
Madam Chair, yes, they are.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Mr. Mueller? Seeing none, I'd like to invite Rebecca Flood to the table. And Rebecca's going to start us off with the governor's proposal for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I understand also the DNR. Welcome, Ms. Flood.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Rummel said, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And on behalf of the seven agencies that are responsible for clean water in the state, we want to thank you for the opportunity and the invitation to present the governor's proposal to you today. And while I'll start the presentation and talk for on behalf of the partner agencies, there are several other agencies that will also be addressing the committee. The purpose of our presentation to you today is to give you a brief background on the Federal Clean Water Act, the State Clean Water Legacy Act, and the clean water portion of the recently passed constitutional amendment. We'll also address our watershed approach as an organizing framework for the expenditure of amendment money and the development of the joint agency's proposal for expenditure of funds under the amendment. The concept of impaired waters comes from the Federal Clean Water Act. It requires Minnesota to assess the quality of its rivers, lakes, and streams. The PCA must take these data, the chemical, biological, hydrological, and physical information, and analyze it to determine whether water quality standards are being met. A water is considered impaired if it does not meet these standards. Those waters not meeting water quality standards are then placed on the Clean Water Act Section 303D list, or the impaired waters list. The list is developed in April of evenly numbered years and submitted to EPA for its approval. Once a water is listed as impaired, a restoration or TMDL plan must be developed. And TMDL stands for Total Maximum Daily Load. It wouldn't be a government program without an acronym. Or the maximum amount of a pollutant that can go to a water body and have the water body still meet water quality standards. This TMDL plan, in conjunction with local water management plans, will guide the activities that need to occur to restore the water body so that it meets water quality standards once again. In 2006, the legislature passed the Clean Water Legacy Act to provide guidance and resources to implement these Clean Water Act requirements. And the Annandale-Maple Lake lawsuit and a concern for halted development was also a significant reason to address impaired waters and contributed to the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act. In addition to providing this one-time funding, the Clean Water Council was created by the Act to advise the agencies, the governor, and the legislature on the implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act. The seven agencies have worked together to support the work of the Clean Water Council and to coordinate its water responsibilities. One of the other requirements of the Clean Water Legacy Act directed the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to develop a framework to monitor and assess the waters of the state on a 10-year rotating basis, and I'd like to tell you about that next. As I just mentioned, the one-time funding from the Clean Water Legacy Act allowed us to develop a framework to monitor and assess lakes and streams in the state on a 10-year rotating basis. It's organized on a major watershed scale, allowing us also to integrate our activities with local and citizen monitoring efforts. In addition, it allows us to focus our protection and restoration activities as we rotate throughout the state. The next slides show just how this monitoring framework operates. And here's how the watershed framework will operate under our proposal. As you'll see here, we conduct intensive biological, chemical, and physical monitoring at the base of each of the 81 major watersheds. The base is the same as the mouth of those watersheds, and it's the point at which they discharge into major basins. We also monitor the outlets of the major watersheds every year in cooperation with the DNR, the Metropolitan Council, the U.S. Geological Survey, and local partners. And then we'll also monitor lakes greater than 500 acres in size and a smaller number of representative lakes in the watershed. And you'll notice here that we don't focus just on one area of the state, but are evaluating areas across the state. Following the data collection and analysis, TMDLs, or watershed management plans, will be developed. TMDL restoration plans will be developed when we find an impaired water, one of those that don't meet standards, and protection plans can also be developed when a water body is not impaired. The watershed framework allows us to understand what is needed within a watershed and develop a watershed management plan that fits those circumstances. The framework is focused on watersheds and not limited to county boundaries, and thus it's important that local entities are involved in the development of these plans. And over 80% of the study money is passed to local entities for these reasons. When we've gone out and done monitoring of lakes, rivers, and streams across the state, we've found that approximately 40% of those water bodies that we monitor are actually impaired. And this slide illustrates where we might find in a watershed both impaired and unimpaired water bodies after we've conducted that intensive monitoring effort, and how we might integrate protection and restoration efforts and connect to local water management plans. So you see here in the red, those are illustrating impaired areas, and the rest of the watershed would be unimpaired. So in the red, you would get both a restoration plan developed, and in the green areas, the not impaired areas, those are the areas in which we would develop protection plans.
Assistant Commissioner, you would cover all 81 watershed in 10 years?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's the intention of this framework, yes. Once the plans are prepared, and then implementation of protection and restoration can follow. These efforts continue through the next monitoring cycle until the plan is updated 10 years later based on that new monitoring data. We anticipate that depending on the nature of the impairment, that some watersheds will be restored within that first 10-year time frame and can then be removed from the impaired waters list. These waters would then become part of the protection plans that are developed for the watersheds so that we can maintain quality. Other waters will require more work and longer time frames for restoration to be completed. Adjustments to permits and best management practices may be needed, or additional time for the water resources to recover, and then they become a part of the subsequent effectiveness monitoring and evaluation.
Okay, good to know.
The Clean Water Legacy Act provided these criteria. We use them to help determine our monitoring rotation schedule. And I'll show. And as you see, this is kind of a rotation, an example of a rotation throughout the state in those watersheds that we select. And the most important word on this chart is the word draft. This schedule will always be draft or tentative, since on an ongoing basis, we'll refine that schedule as we get input from the public and from the Clean Water Council. This allows the appropriate flexibility to adjust work on new information, and you'll see this as we talk more about fiscal year 2010 and 2011. The watershed framework provides a systematic method to identify both impaired and unimpaired waters. It provides good coverage of stream and lake sites within each major watershed. It identifies problems within a watershed on the same time and scale, and provides an opportunity to coordinate efforts with other agencies, local units of government, and volunteers. The seven agencies will be using this framework to to focus our monitoring, assessment, our plan development, and protection and restoration dollars and efforts. This slide provides an overview of how the seven agencies have developed a systematic approach to evaluating, restoring, and protecting our water resources. As you can see, really, this framework provides a continuous improvement loop where we do baseline assessment, plan development, we do implementation activities, and return to conduct effectiveness monitoring to check how things are progressing. We have discussed this approach with the Clean Water Council and other interested parties and believe there is a general concurrence that this provides the most reasonable approach to ensure dollars are spent efficiently and effectively. Now, with this background and explanation of our framework, we turn now to the Joint Agency's proposal, which started with the passage of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment this past fall. The passage of the land and the passage of the water amendment was an important accomplishment for Minnesota, and we are very pleased and grateful that the citizens of the state are so committed to protecting the environment. As you know, the amendment directs one-third of the increased tax receipts to be used for clean water to protect, enhance, restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, with at least 5% of the funds to be spent to protect drinking water sources. Revenues for the Clean Water Fund are expected to be in the range of $70 to $80 million annually. The first biennium is expected to be less due to the economic slowdown. The proposals reflect this reduced expectation. Fiscal year 2010 is budgeted to be half of the level of fiscal year 2011. No slowdown is expected in monitoring and assessment, which is the foundation piece of the Clean Water Law at the federal level and, of course, our very own Clean Water Legacy Act. The design of the watershed framework allows for adjustments so that the 10-year cycle can be maintained. The Clean Water Fund will continue the momentum of the Clean Water Legacy Act. The Clean Water Fund proposal is a joint effort of seven partner agencies: the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, Departments of Agriculture and Department of Health, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Public Facilities Authority, as well as the Metropolitan Council. With the passage of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, the partner agencies came together to develop a comprehensive approach for effective and efficient use of the clean water funds. Our first meeting was held this past December. The partners have developed a coordinated and efficient approach for protecting and restoring the state's waters. The proposal submitted by PCA and its partners and included in the governor's budget proposal requests that funds be allocated for water quality monitoring and assessment, $15.56 million, or 13% of the request, water quality study plan development, those TMDLs, and restorations plans at $25 million, or 21% of the request, water quality protection and restoration activities, $68.4 million, or 58% of the request, and drinking water protection at $9.2 million, or 7.8% of the request. In monitoring and assessment, three agencies propose responsibilities in this area: the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Agriculture, for a total of $15.56 million. Our anticipated outcomes in this area include intensive monitoring of rivers and streams once every 10 years for both water quality and water quantity, monitoring of major watershed outlets every year with Department of Natural Resources, the Metropolitan Council, USGS, and other local partners, monitoring all lakes greater than 500 acres at least once every 10 years, monitoring at least 25% of lakes smaller than 500 acres at least every 10 years, increased pesticide monitoring, increased fish tissue mercury monitoring, and increased development of biologic monitoring.
Excuse me, Assistant Commissioner, would you go into a little bit more detail on those last three, especially increased development of biologic monitoring?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Natural Resources is working on development of additional biologic monitoring, and if Steve Hirsch is here, I'd like him to maybe address that for the committee.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hirsch.
Madam Chair, members, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Resources Director. Can I ask that you repeat the question, please?
And under the outcomes, the last three are increased pesticide monitoring, increased fish tissue monitoring, and then especially I'm curious about what you mean by increased development of biologic monitoring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The biological monitoring is actually what we call an index of biotic integrity that we're developing. And this is basically sampling of non-game fish communities and determining the water quality based on the composition of the fish species that you find. So in order to develop a tool like that, you have to do a lot of sampling in lakes across the state, get a range of species assemblages that you find in waters that are relatively clean, waters that aren't so clean, and then start to develop an index basically on which species of fish are indicators of which types of water quality.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I would also add that the increased fish tissue mercury monitoring is also being conducted in conjunction with this by the DNR.
Thank you. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hirsch, why do you pick non-game fish species to do this monitoring?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, the main reason is because we don't sample non-game fish species as routinely as we do in other types of sampling that the department does, and often they're more sensitive to water quality changes and habitat changes than some of the game fish species are. So they make, overall, they make better indicators of changes in water quality.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Hirsch, do you ever use other species like frogs or clams to make these assessments or mussels?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, we have not, but there is potential with some of those species too. Even aquatic invertebrates would be species that would have potential to develop a tool like that. But right now our emphasis has been with the non-game fish.
Thank you.
Here's the
Oh, Senator Anderson.
Well, before we go on with the testimony, I want to ask Ms. Flood a question. If you know, you said, I'm looking at the goals for small lakes and large lakes. How many lakes are there that are more than 500 acres, and how many are there that are smaller?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if you exclude Lake Superior, approximately 75% of the lakes in the state are 500 acres in size or greater. So I think that gives you a perspective.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner.
And again, that's acre, as measured by acres, not numbers of lakes.
So 75% of them are 500 or more.
Of all the lake acres are greater than 500. 75% of the lake acres are 500 acres or greater in size, not numbers of lakes, Madam Chair.
Okay, could you give us a percent of, in terms of numbers of lakes, how many would be that size?
Madam Chair, I'd like to have Shannon Louthammer, who's our monitoring and assessment manager, address that question.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shannon Louthammer. As Rebecca said, I'm with the water monitoring group of the Pollution Control Agency. And just as Rebecca said, about 75% of all the lake acres in Minnesota are lakes that are 500 acres or greater. That represents about 660 individual lakes out of the roughly 12,000 lakes that we have that are 10 acres or larger. And then for the smaller lakes, lakes between 100 and 500 acres in size, that's about 2,300 lakes. And the total acres are about 488,000 acres.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Okay, I was trying to follow those numbers. I didn't write them down fast enough, but it sounded to me like you basically listed about 3,000 of the lakes. You said about, did I hear you say mm-hmm. that right? About 660 are in that larger size and 2,300 in that medium size, so that's only about 3,000 lakes. And where's the other 9,000 lakes? Are they all smaller than 100 acres?
Ms. Lockhammer?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, yes, that's correct. The large majority of the lakes are smaller than 100 acres. So of the lakes that are 100 acres or larger, that actually represents about 77% of the lake acres, which is one of the reasons why the Pollution Control Agency is focusing on those larger lakes for our monitoring effort, is because it does represent such a large percentage of the total lake acres in the state.
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
I think it would be useful to see a map. If this is mapped out geographically, I'm just wondering if there's differences, like in Senator Fredrickson's part of the state, there might not be so many big lakes as there are in other parts of the state, I'm guessing. Maybe I'm wrong, too. And so would that emphasis kind of reduce the coverage in some parts of the state and increase it in others? It'd be nice to see that plotted out on a map, if you could get that for us.
Madam Chair, we certainly could. And Senator Anderson, also just to make the point that we do have information about the smaller lakes as well through the satellite remote sensing imagery. So we do have all of the lakes that are 10 acres or larger. We at least have the snapshot information. We're also working really hard to get volunteers on all of those lakes doing the transparency measurement, because we do still want to get a good sense for the water quality of those smaller lakes as well. But we can certainly put a map together to better answer that question.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, that raises one more question. So how many of the lakes do have volunteer monitors on them? Do you have any guess? Sure.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, we have about 1,200 volunteers that are monitoring lakes across Minnesota. I actually don't have a breakdown of what size of lakes, but we could get that for the committee if you'd like that.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Laubahn, is it?
Lauthammer.
Do you make a differentiation in monitoring the lakes between those that are what we call deeper water lakes versus prairie potholes that are essentially waterfowl that have essentially no fish in them?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, we don't in our lake planning. One of the things that we have found is that for some of the very shallow lakes, they can be difficult to monitor in the late summer months. That's actually an area where the work that the Department of Natural Resources is doing on developing indices of biological integrity for lakes will be very valuable, because the tools that we have are really focused on kind of open water lakes. Those tools will help us to get a better sense of the quality of those lakes that maybe are fully vegetated or very shallow.
Thank you.
Senator Torres Rain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner or either one, let me see if I understand this. So I would like to have a chart of the acreage, because then it makes it easier for me to kind of grasp this. But if I understand this correctly, the 3,000 that are above 100 acres constitute the largest portion of water, let's say, in terms of acres. And I would like to see then, in terms of acres, what constitute the other 9,000-something. And in this equation, I would like to see how other bodies of water, bodies of water are measured. So if we take rivers, for instance, I think I would like to see the whole picture of the state to see kind of in order of priorities, how do you plan to invest this money? Because it's hard for me to kind of put my head around the 9,000 figure, meaning lakes. 9,000 is big, but then in terms of acres, it seems like it's a smaller portion. But I'd like to see if you could put a table for us.
Madam Chair, Senator, we can certainly try to put something together to address your question.
Thank you.
Do you want to continue?
Here is the expected stream monitoring for the next biennium. It includes biological, physical, and chemical monitoring to characterize stream health. You'll note that local and citizen monitoring are a key component of this, as you'll note in the lighter colored, the tan color there at the top. LCCMR funding helped jumpstart this effort beginning in 2004, and the Clean Water Legacy Act money really kicked it into gear beginning in 2007. Not shown on the slide is our load monitoring effort, which is a partnership among the PCA, the DNR, the USGS, and the Metropolitan Council and other local groups. We are establishing permanent load monitoring stations to track trends over time, provide us data for TMDL and protection studies, and to better understand year-to-year variability. Here is the expected lake monitoring for the biennium, and you'll notice that a significant amount of the monitoring is being done by citizen volunteers and local governments through pass-through grants provided with the Clean Water Legacy Act and amendment funding. The PCA is focused on monitoring, as I mentioned before, those lakes 500 acres and greater, but also encouraging local volunteers to monitor those smaller lakes. By the end of fiscal year 2009, we will have a sufficient data to assess more than 35% of those larger lakes, 500 acres and larger. Lake monitoring is currently focused on recreational use support, and that index of biologic integrity, or the IBI development, is underway by DNR, as Mr. Hirsch addressed.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I just want to be clear. The monitoring, does some of that take place through the Clean Water Partnerships grants?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, no, they do not. Here is the expected lake. I'm sorry, flip the page. This slide shows the current progression of the annual number of watersheds monitored and the cumulative progress to achieve that 10-year cycle. You'll note in any given year, we may adjust the watershed schedule to accommodate different types of weather impacts, whether it's droughts or floods, those types of events, and other factors. But we have the ability to adjust to ensure that we stay on that 10-year cycle. Particularly, this applies to the fewer number of watersheds that we expect to monitor in fiscal year 2010 due to the lower projected revenues initially present in the Clean Water Fund. Provided that full funding is maintained in future years, we will be able to maintain that 10-year schedule overall. We will do this by balancing out the number of sites needed for the initial watershed assessment and follow-up investigation monitoring sites. The number of sites per watershed range from 3 to 124, depending on the size of the watershed. We must average 360 monitoring sites per year over the 10-year period to maintain that 10-year monitoring rotation. The current schedule ranges from 270 sites to 450 sites per year. Additional monitoring capacity allows for follow-up investigations to identify additional stressors.
Assistant Commissioner, would you go over those numbers again one more time? And I'm assuming that these blue bars are, do those on your graph represent the number of projects? The number of projects may vary year to year, but over the 10-year cycle, you'll get to all of the watersheds?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. And this illustrates how, as we conduct our monitoring over the course of 10 years, it doesn't have to be exactly identical year after year, but we have to average 360 monitoring sites per year in order to achieve our 10-year rotational schedule.
And you made gave us a number of what it would otherwise be?
The number of sites per watershed, depending on the size of the watershed, varies from 3 to 124. I mentioned that we have to average 360 sites per year over the 10-year period to meet our 10-year rotation. And our current schedule ranges from 270 sites to 450 per year.
So when you talk about your current schedule, you're talking about this schedule?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's what this schedule represents.
And before the constitutional amendment was passed, what was your plan to cover the lakes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did not, before the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006, one of our staff has said we were like on the 100-year plan.
Okay.
So it wasn't a 10-year rotational plan. Given the resources that we had, that would not have been possible to do that.
Thank you.
The MPCA and the DNR are also partnering in the development of TMDLs for a total of $25 million. Anticipated outcomes in TMDL development are the addition of approximately 60 more TMDL studies and completion of current projects. The TMDL studies range from 1 to 32 impairments and average 4 to 5 per impairments per TMDL that's completed. It's important to note, again, that 80% of the money that the PCA has received for TMDL development has been passed through to local units of government who actually lead these TMDL study efforts. This also allows us to meet the EPA targets of at least six, doing TMDLs for at least 60 impairments per year.
And Assistant Commissioner, could we go back to the slide where you've got the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the DNR? How does that partnership work? Who does what?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the DNR's primary responsibility here, they have a great deal of expertise in hydrologic and flow gauging, so they are primarily responsible for that effort. The money that would come for this joint proposal, we need them to do that flow gauging for the mouths of each one of these major watersheds in order to do our load assessments.
And the MPCA, their responsibility is actually to go in and test the waters?
Once the waters have been tested, then, Madam Chair, it will show whether or not there's an impairment of a water body. And if there is an impairment, the next step in that action is to figure out what is causing the impairment and develop plans to correct those impairments. And the development of the plans is what this slide addresses.
Got it.
This slide demonstrates the progress in conducting TMDL studies due to the additional Clean Water Legacy Act funding beginning in fiscal year 2007 and particularly increasing in 2008 at the beginning of this biennium. Fiscal year 2010 and 2011 are projections at the level of the governor's recommendation. These are cumulative numbers of TMDL projects. Many TMDL projects address multiple listings of impaired waters, so the number of impaired waters listings being addressed by these TMDLs is about four times greater. For example, a water body may be impaired by several different types of pollutants like phosphorus or ammonia or sediment, or it may have a condition of low dissolved oxygen. We would address all of these impairments at the same time in one TMDL study. These projects will be managed primarily by local units of government through contracts with the PCA. There are currently 98 TMDL studies underway addressing 409 listings. 20 TMDL projects have been completed, and those address 145 impairments. And nine water bodies have actually been restored and are now meeting water quality standards. Five of the seven partnering agencies.
Excuse me, Senator Anderson had a question.
I'm trying to understand the negative numbers up there on the last bar.
Madam Chair, it's actually not a minus sign. It's actually represents approximately.
Oh, yes, my eyes. That's my eyes. Straight from here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, five of the seven partnering agencies propose responsibilities in the protection and restoration category: the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Minnesota Department of Ag, and the Public Facilities Authority, totaling $68.4 million. And you will hear more about these in just a moment. The largest of these are both Bowser and PFA. Bowser proposes grants to local governments and partners for projects and practices to address non-point source implementation, and the Public Facilities Authority for grants and loans to construct public municipal infrastructure for wastewater treatment to address point source pollution and drinking water treatment facilities to assure safe municipal drinking water. Priority ranking for non-point implementation is restoration, followed by protection and source water. The portion of protection and restoration that is a proposed MPCA responsibility is the St. Louis River Restoration Project. This effort will be matched two federal dollars for every dollar spent to restore this river. And at this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Department of Ag, and PFA to further discuss aspects of protection and restoration.
Senator Fredrickson.
The St. Louis River restoration, I'm assuming am I right in assuming that restoration is to a higher standard than the rest of the state because the St. Louis River is in the Lake Superior watershed?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, the restoration that is addressed in this particular project is a result of some legacy pollutants, different contaminants from different industries, and require some intensive remediation activities because of that legacy contamination for metals and
Madam Chair,
and volatiles, that sort of thing.
I understand that, but the still the standards for the Lake Superior watershed is higher than the rest of the state. And my question is, does that include this St. Louis River?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, that you are correct. It will be restored to a higher standard because it is a tributary to Lake Superior.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Madam Chair and Committee. I am here to talk mostly about...
Would you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Julie Clocker, Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm here to mostly talk about the second bullet on this slide, and then I'm going to turn it over to Joe Martin, Assistant Commissioner for Department of Agriculture. So, and then also Terry will be here to talk about the wastewater point source.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Fredrickson, I got me thinking about the St. Louis River too, and so I'm not sure who can answer those questions. How do you? I'm wondering how you get metals out of the water that are already in the water.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I'd like to have Galen Reitz, who is our director of our regional division, answer your question.
Welcome, Mr. Reitz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the regional division at the Pollution Control Agency. Many of the metals that are in the St. Louis Harbor are actually bound in sediment. And so in some cases, they are dredged, and depending on level, they may be hauled off and landfilled. In some cases, it may actually be better to actually seal them in place so that they can't be disturbed by putting some kind of a layer over them. So depending on the situation, what metals they are, where they're located, what their chance for disturbance is, different approaches are used depending on the specific metal.
Thank you, Mr. Reitz.
Thank you.
Ms. Clocker.
Okay, Bowser is in charge of doing non-point implementation. So once the DNR and PCA go out there and determine that a water is impaired, they kind of do the diagnosis, and we go in and help with the local government units kind of do the treatment end of it, as well as putting in protection measures. So we implement all of our programs. Bowser is a very small agency. We only have 70 people. We implement all of our projects through using the local delivery system, which is already established. And that is established through county SWCDs, county local water planning management units, water management districts, all types of different local delivery systems. Because we work through those local delivery systems, we also really optimize land use authorities. Because they have land use authorities, any kind of protection or restoration methods that have to include additional kinds of ordinances or regulations or review processes at the local level, we find that implementation is better served through that. We also, our proposal includes building on the Clean Water Legacy success. And we have a handout that was given to you that highlights a couple of the projects that were funded in 2007 through the 2009 appropriation. And the front page of that, you'll see we include information about how much of the funding went towards each of the major basins, not the watershed units, but the basins. Inside, you'll see a little bit about restoration and protection. And then on the back side, you'll see how we do our tracking for all of our conservation practices through our e-link program. So that's information for you, as well as there's a one-page double-sided handout that has just a very brief summary of all of the different types of funding that came to Bowser for implementation through the 2007 through 2009 allocation, just to give you an idea of what we have done in the past. And it worked very well. We worked with all of the other agencies in order to do prioritization, ranking, develop our proposals. All of these were, not all of them, but most of the dollars were funded through competitive grants. And so we worked on those together in order to prioritize how we were going to select grant recipients.
Ms. Clacker?
Yes.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about the criteria you use to prioritize?
Yeah, if it would be okay with you, Chair, I can get to that in the next slide.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So we build on the Clean Water Legacy Act success, and I also think a really important thing here is that we can really leverage the heck out of these dollars. The Farm Bill in the last 10 years has brought in over $1 billion to this state. Last year alone, it was almost $150 million. Through CRP, through EQIP, through WIP, through all kinds of things. When we get these dollars out to the local units of government, they are ready to pull together a funding package for anybody who wants to do a conservation practice that includes things from the Farm Bill, FSA, NRCS, or any kind of local dollars that might be available. So we kind of see ourselves as a catalyst, being able to pull together all those different kinds of funding practices for implementing non-point protection and restoration. We also, in at least 90% of it, we do require a 25% match. Usually the 25% match is exceeded. So we do leverage a lot of the funding. It's important to note some of the agency initiatives that we are currently working on. Bowser has a number of different grant programs, and what we're trying to do is streamline our grant process. And while that's not necessarily specific for this, it's very helpful as far as all of our LGUs, instead of having to apply for multiple types of grants, we're going to have a unified process. So on their end, it's going to make life a lot easier. Part of that is that we are working towards a program looking at Washington State. They have this program where they called it front-end loading. All of their local units of government basically submit their request for funding even prior to their legislative session, so that when Bowser would come in the future, we would have, you know, every SWCD, every watershed management organization has asked for these funds for these projects. We come to you and say, this is what we know can get done in the next 2 years. Funding's based on what we already know can be done. And then since it's already built into our system, we can funnel the money out for all of those different projects and have them report immediately on them. So it's much more streamlined than what it is now.
So, Ms. Clacker, what you are saying that the partnerships and agreements have already come together before you come to us?
Madam Chair, yes, that's what we're hoping to do, is have them at least let us know everything that they think that we can do. And have it be categorized, whether it's, you know, feedlots or non-point implementation or whatever it might be, so that we have it categorized, we can come to you and let you know everything that we think can happen in the next, you know, 2 years. So that's what we expect 2 years from now, to be sitting here with a very well thought out plan for how these funds would be allocated. And so you already are going to know your results and outcomes based on that. We've been working on that since May of this year, and it is definitely a huge process. It would involve, you know, a major overhaul of our entire grant system. It will take at least a year to get through, but that's what we would expect to have by the next biennium. We are also looking to enhance our eLink system. eLink is our electronic. It's not just a reporting system. It's actually how our grants are managed. It's how we track all of our grant projects out to LGUs, how they track landowner practices, matching dollars for any kind of funds that might come from the federal or local level. And we also then are able to, through those practices, all of them have dots on maps, and we're able to produce the kinds of information that's on the back of your handout. What we would like to do with that after, you know, we are able to do an upgrade to the eLink system is to provide a web-based query system, so that if you are wherever you are in the state or really nation, and you want to look at maybe a legislative district, maybe a county, maybe a watershed, you can do a query, and it will show you the types of projects that have been done in that area under different kinds of funding streams. And that's part of that public accountability, transparency, letting folks know what's happening with the amendment funding. So in a nutshell, our five major categories for our non-point implementation strategy. I will go through each of these in depth, so I'm not going to go over them now because I know we also have a want to make sure we're on time. Protection and restoration is the overwhelming majority of the funding that we're looking at, $24.7 million in the biennium. Most of this is for restoration, and by most of it, anywhere between 65 to 75 is the anticipated amount. Restoration meaning going towards impaired watered areas. And then protection would be the second priority. So those areas where we have high-quality resources and we have well-developed protection plans that can clearly indicate how doing best management practices or projects on the landscape will keep water quality maintained. And then the third thing that we want to do is make sure that we are doing source water protection. There are many source water protection plans out there. Implementation funds have been hard to come by. We know that the constitutional amendment included drinking water protection, and we believe that using the same approach to take a percentage of the implementation funds, put it towards source water protection, we will get great benefit. Many of the practices are still the same. It's just how you define the water. Instead of it being surface water, it's about where the groundwater is going to be protected for drinking water supplies. Again, this builds on the Clean Water Legacy success. The way that the interagencies had worked together in order to determine ranking and prioritization for the grant funds, it was based on a relationship to specific plans. And so when the grant application came in, how closely could they tie what they were going to do with what they were trying to accomplish? And it included measures. You needed to submit how you knew how many parts per billion of phosphorus you were going to reduce from, you know, the receiving surface water. So they were very tight measures that were included in the application process. We also looked at measurable results and the estimated effectiveness. So if you were going to only, you know, fund something at $20,000, but we know that it's going to get 75% effectiveness, obviously that's going to be ranked higher. We also based it on leveraging readiness. Do they have folks that are out there that are ready to go, or do they have to hire, or do they have to wait? Do they think this is going to happen next year or in several years? Support for the project, and then cooperation. We really want to make sure that all our local units of government are out there working together and that they also have support from lake associations, river groups, schools, whatever it may be. With this type of funding, we estimate about 40 to 60 LGU grant projects, and those grant projects themselves may involve multiple types of practices, in some cases maybe just a single practice. But it will all depend on the type of funding that's requested through the application. Through our local resource conservation and preservation grants, $3.25 million, this would be going out to support local government units who are looking to increase the protection and restoration strategies that they're implementing locally. So an example here is if they would like to include or put into place a comprehensive wetlands ordinance in order to protect wetlands in their area, or possibly adopt additional shoreline standards. So these are targeted for additional protection above any state requirements. It's also to implement ISTS, or individual sewage treatment system inventories, and to address imminent health threat systems of these individual sewage treatment systems. And again, this is building on the success in the past from the Clean Water Legacy Act. We also have in our proposal conservation drainage for almost $1 million. And if you look at this map, you see that the red area is where we have channelized streams and ditches. It's nearly a third of our state, and we believe that it is very important to get conservation drainage in these areas if we're going to really obtain clean water. So the goal of this project, it's kind of more of a startup operation almost, in that we want to make sure that we are going out with public drainage management authorities and working with them in order to do some restoration, retrofits, putting in additional practices in order to make sure that the drainage systems that are out there are fully functioning, as well as protecting public waters while they're at it. So this funding is for implementation of practices. We'd also like to evaluate those practices and find out what really works, and then we can share that information with other drainage authorities when they implement their own practices.
Ms. Clocker, this is going to, of course, reveal some of my ignorance. Tell me a little bit more about what these drainage practices are that you're going to improve.
Madam Chair, one example would be called a side inlet control. When you have a drainage system and it's draining land off of the agricultural areas around it, most of it is coming from just surface flow. And when you have lots of surface flow, you can have gullies, huge erosion, bank erosion. So one of the things is we do side inlet controls where we put in a tile further away from the bank of the ditch so that the water isn't running off land. It has some filtering and is allowed to go into the stream without ruining that bank. That's one example.
Okay, thank you.
The fourth item is our feedlot water quality projects, and that's $3.75 million. And I completely understand that this is hard to see way back there, but what this includes is a picture of a new software that we have available. We used to do something called a FLEVOL, or a feedlot evaluation model, and that would let us know on a rain basis, an individual precipitation basis, what kind of loading you might have from a feedlot. We have a new software system out there right now. It's called MinFarm, and it greatly enhances our ability to understand impacts of feedlots to surface waters because it includes an additional measure in there where we determine what the surface water outlet is. You know, maybe it's a wetland that is not hydrologically connected to a major river or lake, or if it is and it's very close, the prioritization factor goes way up. So we're able to use the new MinFarm system. It was just completed last year in order to really prioritize feedlots where we believe we will get the best impact or the most impact from the feedlot water quality projects is by prioritizing them in riparian and shoreline areas. That's a huge amount of feedlots. And so if we can go out there and do some of the MinFarm analysis, we can really figure out where the best dollars are going to be used for the most impact.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to be clear what the money is for. Is it for the MinFarm program and information, or it's for different kinds of remediation work?
Chair and Senator Anderson, good question. This itself is only for the feedlot project. Technical assistance is provided in other ways. Most of the time it can be through EQIP program, through the federal program, or through our already funding base for SWCDs as it is now, and counties.
So, Madam Chair, I'm still not clear what the money is for. If it's for the feedlot program, what does that mean?
Okay, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson. It's for actually fixing the feedlots. Whether it is an example that I just looked at the other day, it was a small fix. It was under $5,000. And it basically included doing a FLEVOL evaluation to figure out how much phosphorus and biological oxygen demand decreases you would obtained by doing the fix. And then they looked at the way that this feedlot was run. All of the drainage from the roof was just going straight off and then running through the feedlot into an adjacent water body. So the fix included just putting on some gutters, some fascia, and putting a berm where the water wasn't directed directly into the receiving water that was right by there. It was under $5,000. And there's lots of little things like that, but there's also some pretty darn big fixes out there, which may be putting in huge manure basins for $75,000.
Other questions? Senator
Ms. Clocker, could you go back about two slides?
Sure.
To the one that's a local resource conservation and preservation grant?
Yes.
I don't know if you meant to rank those in priority order or not, but I think in the Clean Water Legacy Act, the highest priority would be the last one you have listed there, addressing imminent health threats. So if you redo that slide, I would suggest you put that one up at top rather than the bottom.
Okay. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, just to let you know, I don't have them prioritized, and actually out of the goal for this program would be for at least 2 million of the 3.25 to address both inventory and imminent health threats.
Thank you.
Okay, and then the last budget item that we have, we're calling Measures, Results, and Accountability, and it's $1.87 million. And this is really kind of the quality assurance that the citizens of the states as well as the legislature would be getting from this program. It's our oversight and reporting of LGU performance. How well are they doing at implementing these programs? It includes training, assistance, and certification. We want to make sure that if we're getting $24 million in BMPs and projects out to our LGUs to implement, that they are well-designed, well-implemented, well-inspected, and that we have, again, that quality assurance factor. We also want to include landscape-level resource indicators. Our partner agencies evaluate water quality in streams and rivers and wetlands, including the critters that live there. We would like to see how well we're doing on the landscape. One of the key indicators out in the more rural areas is to make sure that we're doing tillage transect surveys, soil erosion surveys. It's the soil getting into the lakes and rivers that can be where most of the contaminants or sedimentation can come from, causing turbidity, all kinds of things. So we want to make sure that when we're putting the projects out there on the landscape, that the landscape is improving, and therefore water quality will be improving. We also want to make sure that we're having transparent communication about these conservation outcomes, again, through our e-link system, through reporting, through having public query available. Our e-link system right now is available only for LGUs. They log in. They get a code. They put in all of their practices. There's a web snapshot there of what it looks like. It's how we do all of our tracking. We want to make sure that folks anywhere can see what it is that's happening with the constitutional amendment funding. And that's all I have for the Bowser component. And if there aren't any other questions for me, then I would turn it over to Joe Martin from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Cloker? Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Martin. Or is it Assistant Commissioner?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Martin. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'll direct you in your folders. Apologize, I have a cold, so I thought it best I put together the sheet to limit my talking. There's a, it says fact sheet, Department of Ag. And in this fact sheet, you'll find, I thought it was important, we included the work we've done in the past with the Clean Water Legacy, because I think it's important to see what we've done in the past to know what we're going to build upon and proposing to do in the future. And we have four requests in the budget right now. I will discuss three of them today. The fourth one I believe we're going to take up on Wednesday in drinking water. But the main request that we have is building upon our Ag BMP loan program. And this would be for $4.5 million for the biennium. The Ag BMP loan program, it's a program that's been around since 1995. It's capitalized right now at around $60 million, and $3 to $4 million revolves back each year. What the Ag BMP loan program serves as is it's money that's allocated to LGUs, many times it's counties or SWCDs. And in turn, they work with a local lender to help and we have cost share projects, say an 80-20 cost share, to help finance the private sector contribution of that 20%. The main projects we work on are, you've heard in a lot of this, you'll see the interagency interaction here, because in terms of the Ag BMP loans, we'll be working very closely with SWCDs to finance projects like feedlot upgrades or septic system upgrades or conservation tillage equipment. So many times SWCDs are direct beneficiaries of the Ag BMP loan. The important, I think, dynamic to realize what we're moving into is over the last 3 years, we've only had 14 approved TMDL plans in this state, and only those areas that have had approved TMDL plans are eligible to access these dollars. With the last Clean Water Legacy, significant additional resources were allocated to the PCA to do additional TMDL plans, and they've been very successful in that, and we expect another 85 to be approved within this next biennium. So there's going to be a considerable number of new watersheds and LGUs that will be looking to access the Ag BMP loan program along with Kasha. I'll move off of Ag BMP loans if there isn't any questions, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions about the loans? Please go ahead, Commissioner.
The second request is a request for research, pilot projects, and demonstration sites. This was a component of our past work, and you'll see in our sheet the past research that we've been engaged in. Just on working on an interagency basis, we know that there's knowledge gaps. We know that agriculture contributes to impairments, but many times whether we're putting together the plans on exactly how much agriculture contributes, there's still some questions. And the more difficult question is, what practices and where do you need to put them on the landscape that actually are going to improve water quality? So in the past, we've tried to find those knowledge gaps, work with primarily the University of Minnesota researchers. And I think some of this research, we're going to very soon see some results that we're going to share back with our partner agencies that are going to help better understand agriculture's contribution, but more importantly, the remediation steps in terms of improving the water quality.
Assistant Commissioner, when you talk about the water quality, are you talking about surface water or are you talking about groundwater or both?
Madam Chair and members, we've been focused on surface water in the past, but when we get into on Wednesday, we're Department of Ag also has a role in groundwater and nitrate, so you'll see that request coming from us also.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, how do you choose the researchers that conduct this research? Is it through an RFP process or contract? How do you select the projects and the researcher?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, you're correct. We've conducted an RFP process, and we set up an interagency review team many times to look through the projects. We usually identify, in the past RFPs, we've identified some general areas of priority, but then we put out the RFP for the areas of focus, and then the selection committee looks through them.
Continue.
I'd also add that in terms of not just research projects, I think there are some innovative thoughts out there in terms of some pilot projects or demonstration farms for the future where once we find the right practices to place in the landscape of maybe working within the government or working with NGOs in establishing some sites that people can actually visit and see what's working, because many times a picture says 1,000 words. And we've seen that in the past with research stations, but looking more to on-farm research that validates some of the things that we thought for a long time. And lastly, you'll see a request for additional pesticide monitoring. As Department of Ag, we are the lead agency in terms of pesticides. And what this request essentially does is we have a general assessment across the state for watersheds that we monitor for pesticides. The major bottleneck right now is pesticide analysis. There is no field survey. All water samples need to come back to the laboratory to go through analysis. And right now our bottleneck is in terms of additional piece of equipment and chemists to actually run samples. So I think it's the first in the process of running additional samples to identify areas of state where we may be seeing additional problems that may lead to additional actions in the future. Madam Chair, that includes our three components of the request.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking at the pesticide monitoring and assessment, and it does say it will be, it will be testing in surface water and groundwater in this category.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's correct. We'll be looking at both areas, especially in areas where there's both groundwater and surface water interaction.
Exactly. Questions? Thank you so much, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
I believe we have the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority, Mr. Terry Kuhlman.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. My name is Terry Kuhlman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. I don't have a slide presentation, but I did provide a two-page handout with probably a little more information than you want, but I'll cover it. We are a municipal financing entity. If you want to know, our strength really is the municipal bond market and understanding municipal finance. We operate loan programs from clean water, drinking water, transportation. We have credit enhancement programs for social service buildings, criminal justice facilities, water, sewer, storm sewer activities. So we do a variety of public infrastructure. And kind of a diagram of who we are, it's governed by six state agency commissioners. We also contract interagency agreement with DEED to manage their community finance programs, and got a list of those programs there that we also oversee. On the second page, get into the clean water programs we manage. We really have two base programs. By far the largest program we operate is the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is seed capital from the federal government. USEPA provides capitalization grants to us to create a revolving loan program. The state's required to match those funds on a 1-to-5 basis. The last 4 years, the governor requested and the legislature appropriated a 1-to-1 match because the demand was so great and the funds were shrinking in the federal level. So that is our primary base program. And we operate on PCA's project priority list. PCA has a ranking system that ranks all the municipal wastewater and stormwater projects that apply for the funds, get on that list. They have established criteria to do that. Three years ago, we incorporated TMDL in the priority system, so TMDL projects, once an implementation plan has been approved, tend to rise to the top of the list or get added points to that. The second largest program we have, an existing one that's been around for many years, dating way back to the Legislative Water Commission days, probably back in the late 80s and early 90s, is the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, and it's really supplemental assistance. It supplements the revolving loan program for projects in small communities that are high cost, meet a certain threshold, and need additional assistance. Or they'll match USDA Rural Development Grant Program. When USDA Rural Development calculates a grant level that a city needs to complete a project to keep a certain level of affordability, the state used to match that 50-50 with USDA Rural Development. Last year, we increased that match to 65%. The state actually provides 65% of the funds because their grant funding was cut back and their loan funds increased, and to be able to do more projects at their level without losing the money in Washington, we increased the grant amount. And by matching them, USDA agreed to follow the state priority. So we brought another program in to help address state wastewater projects.
Mr. Kuhlman.
Now, those are the base programs. Now, the Clean Water Legacy are the programs we're requesting money for a little
Could I ask you a question before you move on?
Oh, sure.
How will this – will there be stimulus dollars that add to these federal dollars?
Yes, Madam Chair. On the very last page, I put a summary of the stimulus package, which isn't related to the Clean Water Legacy – or clean water account. but just kind of a summary of the funds we're getting for clean water and drinking water. We're actually getting $72 million in clean water, but we're allowed to transfer 30% of the drinking water over and vice versa, and we are going to transfer 30% of the drinking water funds over to clean water because the demand is so great there, and our ability to leverage drinking water projects is significant, where we've been leveraging the clean water program pretty much at the maximum capacity. So, and unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately, the stimulus money will all be under contract and probably even most 90% of it spent before we even see the first penny of sales tax come in. Those projects are lined up and ready to go. Just a matter of the hurdles like that we have to deal with as far as reporting paperwork and some of the requirements in that bill, getting those figured out. And we do have to get legislation, which Senator Fredrickson's carrying amongst many other co-authors, to allow us to make grants out of the revolving loan fund, which has been prohibited by federal law until the Stimulus Act passed. So that's kind of a summary.
I didn't mean to anticipate you.
But back to the three Clean Water Legacy programs, these are all part of the Clean Water Legacy Act, and they were all set up with the intent of tapping future dedicated funding for clean water fund. These were created really looking at where the gaps existed in clean water, what we couldn't address, and cities looking at really what is additional, what they call unfunded mandates. I don't necessarily like that phrase, but additional requirements they had to meet over and above existing permits, and they wanted funds to address some of those. And I'll explain the three programs. The Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program is really a two-prong approach, and this is designed for communities that really fall under below, so small they fall below PCA's permit thresholds. Towns of 30 households or less, a lot of them are straight pipe communities with, you know, a dozen homes hooked up to a drain tile going direct into a river, failing septics, usually associated with contaminated water wells at the same time, shallow wells, shallow septics, bad septics, non-conforming septics. In this program, it's a two-phase approach. The first is a technical assistance grant, which is a maximum grant of $40,000. It's a base grant of $10,000 plus $500 per household to hire a designer to look at the soils and lot size and whether or not septic systems can be replaced in work and be in conformance with septic standards. Otherwise, then look at maybe like mound system or cluster systems to address the problem, but trying to avoid the municipal wastewater treatment where they need licensed operators and a lot of expense that the communities just simply can't afford when they're that small. Also, part of that grant is they can contract with University of Minnesota Ag Extension to look at the financial managerial and technical capacity of the community to operate and maintain those septics because we require them to be publicly owned, and that community needs to come up with a plan to operate and maintain them, in essence, you know, collect fees so they can pump them every 2 years, get them inspected, make sure they're in conformance, and eventually replace them when they need replacing. So U of M has kind of stepped up in that role, as well as educating homeowners on what they can put down their septic systems to make them last versus what they can't. So there's education involved by all parties there with U of M. So it's a great process to get them started. And then we offer a loan program for everybody, but communities under the statewide median household income, it's a 50% grant, 50% loan. We're really looking for clean water legacy money to operate that program. Our base budget last biennium had $100,000 in it for technical assistance grants. It's still there. We're not supplanting, but we do want to add to it. $100,000 doesn't go very far, 2.5 projects. We'd like to see that increased by another $250,000. I think PCA said roughly there's about 60 communities right now in TMDL areas with straight pipe communities, and we expect that number to grow drastically as time goes on, identifying kind of the hot spots that need to be addressed. Senator
Anderson.
I just want to follow up on that. I was going to ask you how many communities. So you said that there's about 60 communities that have
currently on the
TMDLs that have straight pipes?
Not necessarily all straight pipes, but non-failing. The very first TMDL identified quite a few. That was a fecal coliform TM down southeast Minnesota. Communities, a lot of them are just intersections where clusters of home were built around, you know, the so there's really not a city involved, a government entity. But, they found a lot of straight pipes doing TMDL work. And it's not necessarily straight pipes in the sense that it's a straight pipe from the home, but, you know, they'll have a septic tank, but after years, you know, it fills up, and if they're not pumped and inspected, and then it's eventually connected to a tile or goes someplace, and it's identified. And that exists.
And so, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
You said you expect a whole bunch more to come, and that's after we complete more TMDLs, we'll find more. Is that what you
yes,
were referring to?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson.
Okay, and the money you're requesting, I've lost track of which request that is. That's the 2.875 request, or?
Yes, it
the
is. That program we are requesting, really a base budget we're looking at is about $100,000 in general fund and $250,000 in the sales tax to do the technical assistance work. And right now we have some bond proceeds that we're doing the implementation, the actual improvements, but in the second year we're looking for a $2 million level funding for that program.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm trying to
Senator Anderson.
Trying to follow along here.
Okay.
On your sheet, and I'm not following. So the page 3.
On page 3, you'll see 285,000.
I see 2.875 million.
Yeah. We intend to ask for $2 million as kind of the second year of the biennium for actual construction and $250,000 for to do the technical assistance groundwork up front. And the first year, the balance is just to get whatever the governor let us apply for the first year for funding, which was half the technical assistance at 1.25, and then the rest into implementation. But we do have $1 million in bond proceeds from the last bonding bill that we'll be using this year.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you have budget pages that really lay out all those numbers you just went through quickly. I haven't looked at the budget pages yet, and maybe it's all in here.
Yes,
details.
It is. It's broken down, and that's the total you'll see. But it's broken down by year in the budget pages.
And, Madam Chair, really the question I wanted to ask is, okay, so for that amount of money, how many of these communities are you going to be able to fix or help fix?
Yeah.
Mr. Coleman.
Yeah, over time, we eventually hope to get them all. But with $2 million, at a minimum of 4 a year, there's a max of 5. Actually, we're looking at, Jeff was saying, about 13 to 15 communities to get the technical assistance component, and then 7 or 8 actual construction projects. And again, it depends on the cost. I mean, we put a cap of $500,000 per year, because we figure that's about the max community can handle and some of the contractors can do in replacing septics. But we allow under statute, if they still need additional money for implementation, they're the first on the list to get next year's money until they can go up to 3 years or like, I believe. So
Madam Chair,
the amount of money they get per year.
And I know, this You maybe have spent more time on this in the other committee, in the Economic Development Budget Division, but I feel like we need a little bit more help trying to figure out what our goals should be here, because it sounds like, 7 or 8 construction projects a year, 60 communities already, and we expect that to grow a lot. That, you know, are we on track? What kind of a timeline are we on track to try to solve this problem
across the state. Senator Anderson, time will tell. This is a brand new program,
okay.
And we just started out. And if there is a hurdle, right now it's the public ownership of the septics. We could literally add a zero to this amount if we went privately with private replacement of septics. But I'm not sure we want to go there yet because we want to kind of maintain some control on the operation and maintenance of the facilities, which
Well, Senator Anderson,
we kind of lose control when we do let homeowners own and operate the system.
Senator Anderson is anticipating the question I have. Is there any way that somebody can give us a sense of the scope of these issues as a total?
Yes.
And then over time, how we plan to address the whole picture?
Right.
Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make an additional comment. As I remember the testimony and discussion, these systems are publicly owned, but they're in a sense like private septic systems, mm-hmm. and drain field systems or whatever the system is, and they're publicly owned so that an entity of the local unit of government has access to the property and can make sure that the systems are maintained the way they are supposed to be maintained. And that public ownership was an item of contention when this program was being established, and there are some homeowners that don't like the idea of somebody being able to come on their property mm-hmm. and inspect their system. And
yes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Coleman, did I accurately recall our discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, you did. And for those homeowners that don't want their septic system owned by the government, I mean, it really is a housing rehab program, and mm-hmm. we do encourage them to contact agencies if they need financial assistance that provide that assistance on home ownership or home improvement loans. And then there's also, if they are a direct pipe, there's the $500 a month fine that can be levied if it's reported to PCA, and that's a motivating factor. So
that would be motivating.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, if it was enforced.
If it was enforced. Senator Deal.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Coolman, I was just sitting here thinking about different things. I'm just wondering if we're getting to a point here, at least in some cases, where maybe our water is getting too clean. And I'm thinking about the obesity problem in this country. When we had a bunch of smokers, we're down to 18% smokers now. If we just had more smokers, there'd be less obesity. And by taking in those toxins every day, you compromise your body's ability to gain weight. And now we've got all this clean water, and in the old days we used to be able to get a little bit sick and compromise our ability to get fat.
I don't necessarily connect all those connections.
Well, for example, we've got this arsenic issue out there where there used to be 50 parts per million or billion or something like that, and I know it's dropped to 10 because of something the federal government had us do. And so we're making communities out there spend a lot of extra money to get down to that 10 parts per whatever it was. And maybe we got the standards so low that the added public health benefit is not there, and maybe there's a public health benefit if we did have some level of microorganisms, low pathogenic E. coli or something to try to keep our weight down. I know it sounds a little ridiculous, but we think we get fat because we don't exercise. Maybe we get fat because the water is just too darn clean.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, I've been drinking a lot of bottled water, which I need to break myself, but I've lost a lot of weight since I stopped drinking municipal tap water, but so I don't know. But, yeah, I won't argue with you. I think animals have a tendency to build up immune systems to a lot of contaminants, and humans are no different, so And I know from my own experience, I travel around the state a little bit, and prior to working for state government 20 years ago, I did more of it. And even talking with some of you, the legislators that travel around and get sick drinking water from different communities that have different levels of maybe acceptable levels, but still high levels of nitrate or things like that, and they get migraine headaches because of the effect on it. Doesn't bother people who have been living there for 20 years, but stop and have a cup of coffee or at a public meeting, you can get sick or diarrhea, things like that. So your immune system does build up with certain contaminants. And if you're not used to them, it can have an adverse effect on your body.
The other thought I had as I was sitting here was that we've got fluoride in the water, and I'm glad it's there, but it does make our teeth much more effective for a longer period of time so we can masticate our food better, and that may contribute to some weight gain as well.
Madam Chair, just remind
Senator I don't plan to be a scientist or a doctor. I tend to lend money.
Madam Chair, it's Senator Dill's birthday, so I think we should humor him.
Madam Chair,
Senator Fredrickson.
Thin and sick does not equate with being healthy.
Mr. Coleman.
The second program is part of the Clean Water Legacy Act, and designed to funding is a total maximum daily load grant program. And that's specifically to cover 50% of the cost identified in the when a TMDL implementation plan is adopted, and cities have to increase treatment over and above current permits to address that TMDL. This program will cover half the cost of doing that. And that was program really pushed real hard by municipalities as part of this process. And the last one is the phosphorus reduction grant program. And since phosphorus has been identified as, you know, kind of a statewide implementation strategy to reduce the level of phosphorus down to 1 milligram per liter. I know that one of the programs that the League of Minnesota Cities pushed was trying to cover those costs as that standard increased statewide to 1%. And a lot of TMDL studies that are done now in phosphorus being a pollutant, the cities have to get down to like 0.3%. And that was initially started out at a 75% grant, but in 2011 will convert to back to a 50% grant and basically be the same as the TMDL grant program. But those are the three programs, Madam Chair, and they're over and above what we normally do with our regular financing, and that's what we're asking funds for. But and they're also listed in priority order of what my board thinks are really priorities. That is, we feel the biggest gap out there as far as lack of funds are the small communities, septic, and then followed by the TMDL and phosphorus.
Well, are there additional questions for Mr. Coleman?
Madam Chair, I do.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. I was looking at the federal economic recovery money, and I noticed that it says a minimum of 20% of the funds have to be used for projects addressing green infrastructure, energy, and water efficiency improvements or other environmentally innovative activities. So it sounds to me like not just going down the list, but looking for sort of higher levels of technology improvements.
Yes.
What are you proposing for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we do plan on going out on a request for proposal as soon as the bill is passed to solicit those projects. EPA is coming out with a guidance to help that. And I think it's, to be real honest, it's more pushing in the direction not only of energy and water conservation, but also looking at stormwater as kind of the push behind it, because that seems to have been an area that causes a great deal of surface water pollution and has not been addressed. And Representative Obestar, this committee passed the reauthorization of the Clean Water Act, which also includes identical language, 20% of the funds be set aside for this, and he really emphasized stormwater in that, as well as energy conservation measures and opportunities like that. But they don't want to mean just change light bulbs to save energy. They want, you know, a major, what they call significant business decision to invest in those type of activities. So,
well, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
I've been kind of shocked about hearing just recently about the level of energy usage that comes from our wastewater treatment plants. I really didn't know that until recently, and it's something I think we should have a little more information on and think about if we can. I mean, what the capacity is for trying to improve that with wastewater technology.
I'm not an engineer, not the best person to ask. But, yeah, it's my understanding, like, Met Council is the largest user of electricity from Xcel Energy with municipal wastewater treatment plants, and it is a very energy-inducive process to treat with the pumps and aeration system and things like that. So it does take a lot of electricity. We are starting to see some technology and financing projects using methane gas to generate electricity to help run the plant or reduce the energy costs. Projects like that being built around the state. The technology is starting to get there, where 20 years ago or even 10 years ago it wasn't there, but it's moving in the right direction. We'll be seeing more of that, and I think this bill, along with the Reauthorization Clean Water Act, is going to push that technology further. You'll see more of it.
Well, I see that Assistant Commissioner Flood has put on the screen questions. First, I wanted to compliment and thank Assistant Commissioner Flood and Clocker for helping organize a very efficient presentation of the governor's budget. I think it was really very orderly and easy to follow. So are there additional questions for anyone that presented today? Again, thank you very much, everyone who put this information together for us, and we look forward to seeing you soon. With that, I think we will adjourn this meeting.
Yes. Yeah.